The early 20th century musicologist A.E. Perkins specialised in the field of folk songs, and he argued in his writings that what makes the best folk songs so powerful is not only the fact they deal with real life situations and events, it's the fact they do so contemporaneously that gives them such a raw emotional edge. That is to say, these songs don't emerge years after the stories which they're telling. They emerge when those stories have barely concluded. Perkins provides an example which he witnessed firsthand. He writes, "The Titanic sank on Sunday, April the 14th, 1912. The following Sunday, I saw on a train a blind preacher selling a ballad he had composed on the disaster. The title was, 'Didn't That Ship Go Down?'" Well, that blind preacher then was certainly quick off the mark, wasn't he? But I know a songwriter who was even quicker off the mark, and he's called Moses. In his case, the year isn't 1912 AD, and it isn't a swanky new ocean liner that has sunk to the bottom of the sea. Rather, it's 1500 and something BC, and it's the Egyptian army that has sunk to the bottom of the sea. And within hours of the event, it seems Moses has a long song ready. Now, I don't know the quality of that Titanic ballad that I referred to just now. Its words haven't been preserved, but I suppose the skill involved in folk songwriting is being able to compose in great haste lyrics that nonetheless are elegant and graceful, lyrics that don't sacrifice finesse for speed. And Moses, I would suggest, has that skill in abundance, because this song then that we have in Exodus 15, 1 to 18, despite the rapidity of its composition, it's beautiful. It really is a sublime piece of work. One aspect of its beauty is its careful, intricate structure. And I just want to spend a minute or two then walking you through that. Now, the song has three main sections. You can see where they are because each section kind of begins and ends in the same way. So there's verses 1 to 5. That's the first section. It begins and ends with the vivid image of the Egyptian army plunged into the Red Sea. Verse 1, the horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. Verse 5, they went down into the depths like a stone. Then there's verses 6 to 12. That's the second section. It begins and ends with references to Yahweh's right hand as the ultimate cause of the Red Sea event. Verse 6, "Your right hand, O Lord, glorious in power, your right hand, O Lord, shatters the enemy." Verse 12, "You stretched out your right hand, the earth swallow them." And then there's verses 13 to 17. That's the third section. It begins and ends describing not now the ultimate cause of the Red Sea event, but its ultimate goal, namely the arrival of the Israelites in God's own dwelling place. Verse 13 refers to God guiding them to his holy abode. Verse 17 refers to God bringing them to the place which he has made for his abode. So those are the three main sections then. There's also, of course, verse 18, but it simply functions as a kind of rousing one-sentence conclusion to the whole thing. The Lord will reign forever and ever. Now, assuming you're still with me at this point and your minds aren't reeling too much from those literary minutiae, I just want to take our structural analysis a step further, because actually each of these three main sections has its own elegant arrangement. And in particular, a close examination reveals this, that in the middle of each section, there's a list. So look again at section 1, verses 1 to 5. And verse 1 is about the demise of the Egyptian army, and verses 4 and 5 are about the demise of the Egyptian army. But in between, in verses 2 and 3, there's a list of the things the Lord is. The Lord is my strength and my song. This is my God, my father's God. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name. You can see, can't you? Those middle two verses are written in quite a different style from the verses on either side of them. Verses 2 and 3 are an inventory. A flurry of short, sharp points. This, 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 and this. It's a list. What about section 2, verses 6 to 12? Well, it's the longest of the sections and features the most elaborate arrangement. So verses 6 and 12 go together, as we've already said. They both talk about Yahweh's right hand. Verses 7 and 11 also go together. They're both about God's superiority. Verse 7, you overthrow your adversaries. Verse 11, who is like you, O Lord? Verses 8 and 10 also go together. Verse 8 is about God by his breath, literally at the breath, not the blast of your nostrils, dividing the waters. And then verse 10, about God by his breath. Literally, you blew with your breath, the same word, reunifying the waters. Which leaves then verse 9, bang in the middle of this section. And again, it's a list. This time a list of I wills. I will pursue. I will overtake. I will divide the spoil. I will draw my sword. So that's section 1 and 2. Then there's section 3, verses 13 to 17. And we've already said then that verses 13 and 17 are both about God ultimately leading the Israelites to his dwelling place. The first part of verse 14, along with verse 16, what's described there is the nations, in general terms, being paralyzed with fear at the Israelites and thus unable to resist as Israel marches from the Red Sea to the Promised Land, which leaves in the middle the second half of verse 14 along with verse 15, where, you've guessed it, we find another list. A list in this case of specific nations powerless to resist Israel's march. There are four of them. Philistia, pangs have seized the inhabitants of Philistia. Edom, now are the chiefs of Edom dismayed. Moab, trembling seizes the leaders of Moab. And Canaan, all the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. So there you are, and I've said enough now about the song's layout. But I had to take you through that because it's these three lists that we're going to focus on for the rest of our time this morning. They're clearly important. That's why each one is right in the middle of its section. And so, as I say, we're going to foreground these lists in our consideration of the song. Consider with me, first of all, then this morning, an adoring list. An adoring list. So this is the list in the middle of the first section, verses 2 and 3. The Lord is, the Lord is, the Lord is, the Lord is. I suppose a series of propositions conveying different truths about God could be dull and lifeless, just cold, dispassionate theologizing. But when you read this list, you know straight away you aren't in that realm. The adjectives dull and lifeless never spring to mind here. There's rather a scintillating breathlessness about these two verses, a captivating irrepressibleness. You sense unmistakably the passion, the devotion, the overflowing love and gratitude. That's why I'm saying it's an adoring list. I suppose its most eye-catching item is the penultimate one. The Lord is a man of war, a warrior, in other words. I wonder what you make of that. The Lord is a warrior. Of course, we talked about this concept last week, so if you were here then, it shouldn't shock you too much. But you might still be thinking, okay, from what was said last Sunday morning, I can see that a warrior God is necessary because naturally as human beings we are under Satan's sway. That's what we need to be saved from, not some bland state of lostness, but rather a deeply formidable state of enemy oppression. So yes, I get the necessity of a God who is combative. I appreciate a Father Christmas-style deity wouldn't be up to the task of smashing our hellish captor. But isn't it a downside of the whole thing that it's a wee bit scary having a God who is like this? A Father Christmas deity may be ineffectual, but at least he's approachable. At least there's going to be some warmth in the relationship there. Isn't that important too? And can there be anything of that when God is this invincible man of war? Doesn't that mean we're going to spend our Christian lives groveling at his feet, unhealthily overawed by this ruthless, overbearing, all-conquering God? You might be thinking that. And my response is no. The fact that God is this almighty man of war doesn't make him austere and unapproachable. Not at all. And this is where the list here is so helpful, because it balances the Lord is a man of war with other statements. And there's one in particular that I have in mind. I remember at the Rugby World Cup in 2019, Wales lost in the semi-final to South Africa, and so they then had to play a game against the losers of the other semi-final, New Zealand, to determine who came third in the tournament. And at the end of that game against New Zealand, as the players were soaking up the crowd's rapturous applause for their efforts throughout the tournament, some of their family members joined them on the pitch, and it was quite a strange sight. There would be this huge hulk of a man, muscles bulging from every part of his body, his head cut and bloodied in the game that he had just played. And you and I might think twice of going and shaking hands with such a fearsome fellow, but then suddenly out of nowhere, a tiny little toddler would run up to the guy and exuberantly fling itself into his arms. It was such an incongruous spectacle. Now, suppose you could afterwards have taken that toddler to one side and probed why he or she did that. Weren't you scared? Weren't you scared of that big rugby player? You just watched him smashing into people and pulling men down to the ground for 80 minutes. Weren't you scared of running up to him and flinging yourself into his arms like that? What would the toddler say? Well, perhaps not very much, but the explanation would probably include one two-letter word. My. That's my dad, the toddler would say. And that little personal possessive pronoun makes all the difference, doesn't it? The child knows approaching that rugby player isn't going to be dangerous. The child knows those rippling arms are now going to embrace rather than tackle. Because of that rugby player, this child can use the word my, my, my. He isn't to me some threatening opposition player. He's mine. Bound and committed and obligated to me as my daddy. I'm saying it's armed with the word my that this toddler can be so gung-ho with a 6 foot, 16 stone giant feared throughout the world of professional rugby. Now look again at this list. In the second half of verse 2, we find this item included. This is my God. This is my God. Do you see the significance of that? It means that you and I as believers can be as confident and fearless and forward in relation to God. Yes, in relation to this warrior God, as that toddler in relation to the rugby player. Because when you and I run up to God and fling ourselves into his arms, we do so like the toddler crying, my, my. He isn't to us a divine fighter bearing down on us to destroy us. He's ours, bound and committed and obligated to us as our God. The arms that crush Satan and the demons are not going to crush us. In fact, there's another glorious item in this list. The list begins, doesn't it, there in verse 2, the Lord is my strength. So it isn't simply that the strength with which God crushes the demons isn't going to crush us because he's our God. Actually, because he's our God, the strength with which he crushes the demons is made available to us to resource our Christian lives to help you in your discipleship tomorrow morning. This is how Donald MacLeod puts it. He says, God says to the believer, I shall use my godness for you. All my godness is yours. All my wealth, all I have and all I am is yours. That, MacLeod says, is God's commitment. And it is as true for each individual believer as if no other entity existed. We have God's undivided attention. He is for us in all the splendor of his resources. Isn't that wonderful? So I'm saying this first list in the song, it's an adoring list. And it particularly highlights that the divine warrior before whom Satan quakes is viewed in a wholly different light by his own people. We run to him. We run to him, crying, my God, my God. It's an adoring list. Notice with me, secondly, an amusing list. An amusing list. So this is the list in the middle of the second section. Verse 9, I will, I will, I will. Who's speaking here? Well, possibly it's the Egyptian army, depicted in a poetic flourish as a single person. More likely, though, it's Pharaoh that's speaking here. It's Pharaoh approaching the Red Sea and declaring what he is going to do to the Israelites. And it's an amusing list, of course, because we know what ignorant, futile boasts these are. Indeed, there's this humorous juxtaposition. In verse 9, we have Pharaoh imagining the ease with which he's going to finish off the Israelites. Surrounding that, in verses 8 and 10, we have the actual ease with which God finishes off Pharaoh. He does it with his breath. The warrior God doesn't even have to fight a grueling battle against the Egyptian monarch in order to win this. Pharaoh boasts and brags. Yahweh just purses his lips and blows him. Blows him. That's the language. Blows him into the depths of the sea. In fact, it's interesting that word congealed there at the end of verse 8. Talking about what God did to the waters of the Red Sea. That word, it's used in Job 10, verse 10, of curdling cheese. As though for God, dealing with Pharaoh is as routine a job as a bit of cheese making is for a dairy farmer. And I think there's something else here. I think we're meant to understand that in his boasting, there in verse 9, Pharaoh is using the kind of language which God habitually uses. So you think of the text with which I began our service this morning. Isaiah 46, verse 10. This is God speaking, I will accomplish all my purpose. Well, that's effectively what Pharaoh is saying here in verse 9, isn't it? I will do this, I will do this, I will do this. No one's going to stop me. And of course, more than that, he speaks, Pharaoh, at the end of verse 9 there, of his hand. My hand shall destroy them. Now, that's certainly God language. It's God language in this very song, as we said earlier, in verses 6 and 12. It speaks of Yahweh's hand. And we saw that in chapter 14 last week as well. And here Pharaoh is speaking of what his hand is going to do. So Pharaoh is using the kind of language that God uses. And he's using it, of course, in relation to God's own people. So this is a very brazen challenge that we have being put out here by Pharaoh. He's effectively challenging God himself. He's saying to him, you might have all these purposes to bless and prosper your people with your mighty hand. Well, sorry, Yahweh, I have my own purposes to destroy your people with my mighty hand. That's what's going on here. And that's the context then in which Yahweh effortlessly blows Pharaoh away. And I think that then adds more color to verse 11. So verse 11 is not just an abstract question, who is like you in your awesome deeds and wonders? There's a more specific focus than that. It's Who is like you in your awesome deeds and wonders, and therefore able to mess around with your people, overriding your good purposes and saving hand with their evil purposes and destroying hand? Who is able to do that? That's what verse 11 is asking, and of course it's asking it rhetorically and jubilantly, because the Red Sea has just shown that no one is able to act like God in that way. There's no one whose purposes and hand can actually rival God's purposes and hand. There's no one whose purposes and hand the people of God need to fear. Perhaps, in fact, we could say this. Verse 11 is really a remarkably similar counterpart to a well-known New Testament passage, to those great verses toward the end of Romans chapter 8. And remember there, just as Moses here uses this who, Paul uses four whos. And in Romans 8:31, he says, what shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? Verse 33, who shall bring any charge against God's elect? Verse 34, who is to condemn? And then verse 35, who shall separate us from the love of Christ? And almost certainly, the who that Paul particularly has in mind is not now Pharaoh. It's the one who I suppose was acting actually behind Pharaoh all along. It's Satan. It's the evil one. I mean, he's the one who tries to bring charges against God's elect, isn't he? And he, of course, is someone who very much, as we've been saying just now about Pharaoh, likes to think of himself as God, and likes to try and usurp God's position so that he tells Jesus there in the wilderness, bow down and worship me. Perhaps the most revealing insight into the heart of Satan we have anywhere in Scripture. That's what he really wants. Worship. Worship. What God alone is due. Satan wants to be God. But you see, Satan's purposes and hand, Paul is saying, must submit to God's purposes and hand, just like Pharaoh's must. Isn't that a wonderful comfort for you and me this morning? That there is nobody out there, not even the arch enemy Satan himself, there is nobody out there who has purposes that can challenge God's good purposes for us. There's nobody out there who has a hand that can take on God's mighty saving hand toward us. We can sing with Isaac Watts, I shall be safe, for Christ displays superior power and guardian grace. Doesn't matter who we're talking about. Whether we're talking about Pharaoh, about Fulani herdsmen, Boko Haram, Satan himself, I shall be safe, for God displays superior power. Always superior power and guardian grace. God's I wills triumph over all the I wills of God's fiercest enemies. Take that to heart this morning, believer. So, an adoring list, an amusing list. But then thirdly and finally this morning, an animating list. An animating list. So this is the list in the middle of the third section. There in kind of the second half of verse 14 and through verse 15, this list of four specific nations that lay between Israel, where they are right now on the shores of the Red Sea, and their goal, their destination, the promised land. This is prophecy, then, we're now dealing with in this third section of the song. You'll notice that grammatically, It's in the past tense. I think the NIV possibly does put it into the future tense. It is in the past tense in the Hebrew, but it's merely in the past tense in the Hebrew, in the same way that, again, in Romans 8, Paul, in the past tense, can write that we are already glorified. Of course, we're not yet glorified, but it's certain. That's the point. We are going to be glorified. And it's so certain, Paul can already write about it in the past tense. And here in the song, it's so certain. It's so certain that none of these nations will be able to resist Israel's onward march, that it can be sung about as if already Israel has waltzed past them. And that is the language there at the end of verse 16, this language of passing by, till your people, Lord, pass by, till the people pass by whom you have purchased. One commentator writes, it has the sense, that verb, it has the sense of getting past the barriers to entrance to the promised land. And that's what these four nations were then. They were barriers. They were barriers standing in Israel's way. If Israel was ever going to inhabit the land of Canaan, there was Philistia, and there was Edom, and there was Moab, and of course there was Canaan, the people who were actually living in the land itself. They were these barriers. But the song is saying, these barriers will be passed by. And the purpose then of this list is animating. It's to animate the Israelites to keep going. Because soon the dust would settle on the crossing of the Red Sea. And the emotional high would start to recede. And suddenly it would become rather daunting. Oh, we're not in Canaan yet, are we? Actually, we're still pretty early on in our journey. There's an awful long way to go. And there are all these barriers. And the song then, this list of these nations that will just melt away before Israel. The song is to animate the Israelites. Keep going. Keep pressing on. You can make it. And you and I, if we're believers in Jesus Christ, we're headed for the ultimate promised land, aren't we? Of which Canaan was a type, a picture, a tiny little preview. We're headed for the heavenly country of Hebrews 11. The world to come. A new heaven and a new earth that Peter and the book of Revelation and Isaiah talk about. And of course, for us, as we stand here this morning, from our vantage point, there are barriers, aren't there? Formidable barriers between where we are now and us crossing the threshold of the ultimate promised land. Not Philistia and Edom and Moab and Canaan, but equally formidable equivalents. Temptation, sin, trials and adversities, the flesh that still dwells within. Just the sheer length of the Christian life, especially if you're a younger person, looking out at it this morning. And if you're spared, there could be decades of negotiating this world and all its difficulties, day after day after day after day after day. But this list animates us then, as it animated or should have animated the Israelites. We will pass by, in the language of verse 16. We will pass by all of these barriers that lie in the way. I've quoted to you before these great words of John Owen in his monumental work, Communion with God. I just love these words. He's talking about the love of God and the way in which it's a powerful love. And he contrasts that with human love, which of course can emotionally be very strong, but it's not powerful in the sense of being able to affect things like God's love is. This is what he says. He writes, a man may love another as his own soul, yet perhaps that love of his cannot help him. He may thereby pity him in prison, but not relieve him, bemoan him in misery, but not help him, suffer with him in trouble, but not ease him. We cannot love grace into a child, nor mercy into a friend. We cannot love them into heaven, though it may be the great desire of our soul. But the love of God, Owen says, is effectual and fruitful. He loves us into heaven. What a sentence. He loves us into heaven. Actually, the song uses the language of God's love, doesn't it? There in verse 13, you have led in your steadfast love the people whom you have redeemed. It is that same idea of God's strong, invincible, indomitable, infallible love sweeping us all the way into the ultimate promised land. And just notice two features of the promised land for which Israel is headed that are highlighted in this third section of the song. Two features. One, intimacy. So as we've already said, there in verses 13 and 17, it's highlighted that this land they're going to, it's God's abode. In some sense, God himself would dwell in Canaan. And of course, there's a lot to be fleshed out there. Once they get to Sinai, and they'll receive all the regulations for the tabernacle, which then will evolve eventually into the temple, and Jerusalem becoming the focal point, and Mount Zion, and all the rest of it. But in some sense, then, God would be dwelling in this land that they were going to. Intimacy. Being in God's own presence, that's one feature highlighted. The other feature of this promised land is security. That wonderful language of verse 17, they will be planted. God's going to plant them there. Not just going to rest on the surface of the promised land, they're going to be planted in it. And are these not two features then that we can transfer also to the ultimate promised land where you and I are headed? Intimacy. We know some intimacy with God now, but not the intimacy with God that we shall know then. You ever notice that interesting feature of Psalm 16? You'll know Psalm 16, many of you. And twice in the psalm, we have the language of right hand, but it's used differently in the two instances. So in verse 8 of Psalm 16, the psalmist says, I have set the Lord always before me, because he is at my right hand, I shall not be shaken. So the psalmist is saying that now in my present experience, as I live here in this world with all its troubles and all its obstacles, God is with me. He's at my right hand, and that's a lovely thing. But notice how it gets better when you come to verse 11. You make known to me the path of life. Now he's looking forward into the future. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. Do you get the distinction? The psalmist is saying, now in this life, you're present with me. You're with me. In my situations, you're at my right hand. In the future, I'm going to be where you are. I'm going to be present with you. I'm going to be at your right hand. Yes, God is present with us now. Certainly in a worship service, but also in some sense in our daily lives. God is present with us. He's at our right hand, but in that land to which you and I are headed, we'll be at his right hand. We'll be where he lives, in his abode, in God's actual place of residence. What a thought. And security. That will be a feature, won't it, of our future. We're not going to live out of a suitcase in the world to come. We're not going to be on the move, passing through. We're going to be planted there. It's going to be our final, everlasting, irreversible destination. So, this lovely song then, with its three lists. And just as we close, let's make sure we don't lose sight of the wood for the trees. Let's step back and remember that this is then, at the end of the day, a song of celebration because of a great victory God has won for his people. And I said, didn't I, when preaching on singing, our singing, a few weeks ago, what is one thing that our singing is? It's a celebration. I mentioned this passage in Judges 4 and 5, Judges 5, the song celebrating the victory in Judges 4. The song's in Revelation. And we have a greater victory than the crossing of the Red Sea to celebrate. Let's be singers. Let's be those who sing the victory that Jesus Christ has accomplished over all the powers of evil in the cross and in the resurrection. And one further thing on that. I haven't mentioned at all the last few verses of our passage, verses 19 to 21, where suddenly Miriam comes into the equation. And there's some debate as to what's going on here. Verse 21, Miriam sang to them. Who's the them? And it reads most naturally like it's the women who are dancing with her. And if so, then the picture is perhaps that she now teaches to the women this song that we've just had in verses 1 to 18. The only thing with that is that it's actually a masculine pronoun. Moses sang to them. Sorry, Miriam sang to them. And so it could be that we have a sort of antiphonal thing going on here. And the men sing verses 1 to 18 and then the women respond with the chorus that we have there in verse 21. That's possible as well. I don't have a strong opinion on that matter, but what is noticeable is just the way in which verse 21 complements verse 1 of our passage. In verse 1, Moses and the people of Israel sang this song to the Lord. Verse 21, Miriam sang to them. Doesn't matter who the them is, but it's other human beings. And isn't that what we said about singing? Singing always has two dimensions. As vertical, we sing to the Lord, and as horizontal, we sing to one another, to build each other up, to impress the truth of the gospel on each other. And as then, after the Lord's Supper, in a few minutes, we sing a victory song of heaven's champion who has won for us, Jesus Christ. Let's sing it to his praise and glory, and let's sing it reminding each other we have a champion who is worth singing about. May God bless his word to us. Amen.